tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
A divorce or, you know, a medical emergency where you end up in the hospital not being able to work for a very long time, not being able to support your family, that can pretty much hit any individual in this society. And I think that people are not aware of this fact that eventually they might benefit from a system like this.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribunal del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided later on in the show. Our guest today is a recent graduate from the University of Wyoming. As a Fulbright scholar from Germany, she received a master's degree in sociology. Annette Tesley came to the U.S. interested in the 1996 welfare legislation, where her research focused on the federal concept of welfare to work and its role in rural Wyoming. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. That's great. I'm glad you could be with us. What piqued your interest in coming to the United States, and not only coming to the United States, but coming and studying welfare?
Well, I got into an exchange program scholarship. That's what sent me to Wyoming, and I became interested in welfare legislation and the 1996 change in it, because in Germany and Europe in general has a much more generous welfare program. I was kind of taken back by the extreme dismantling of the welfare state in here and in the United States in 1996, and that's how I became interested in studying it.
Why is the 1996 legislation so important?
Because it just dismantled the welfare state to such a huge extent, which is never seen before. It's like unprecedented. And I thought it was quite shocking on how much blame is put on an individual, or how structural explanations of poverty were totally taken out. It was individual responsibility, and the whole focus of the legislation was on changing the individual's behavior and integrate it back into society. Because the assumption was that they have some kind of dysfunctional values that are counterproductive and exclude them from mainstream society, and the main focus was on, you know, bringing those individuals back into mainstream society.
What are some core examples in the legislation that display this focus on the individual as being bad?
Well, if you look at Wyoming's legislation or at Wyoming's power program, it's very evident that there is a absolute strict work for first policy. There is no room for education or very limited funding for education. So if you want to address the individual's human capital, there's not much funding there, and it's not recommended really. So what happens is that people are pushed into employment rather to improve their human capital, or, you know, other shortcomings, improving childcare so people have a place to drop off their children and go to work, or improve transportation. And those kind of issues are not addressed in the program. It's really work first, and you have to go. And if you don't comply with the program requirements, then the penalties for not complying are very, very strict in Wyoming especially.
Can you talk more a little bit about what power is and what that means?
Well, each state had the opportunity to develop their own welfare programs, and in Wyoming it's called POWER. It's the Personal Opportunities with Employment Responsibility Act. And so the Department of Family Services actually developed that program and pretty much implemented federal guidelines in there, and their attitude towards poverty and what they think causes poverty had a very strict or very heavy influence on how the program looks now.
How does this program compare to other state programs that have been implemented?
Well, I compared the Wyoming program to the federal program that was developed, which is the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, and also to the Shoshone 477 program. So that's the only comparisons I can make. I think compared to the federal guidelines, it's very strict, because wherever Wyoming had flexibility, they implemented much stricter rules than were suggested by the federal government. I think the only guideline they went with the highest limit on is the time limits. So they implemented a 60-month time limit for receiving cash benefits. But any other program rule, they are much stricter than suggested by the federal government.
You talked a little bit about work first. What does this mean for people who have been on welfare?
The biggest problem that Wyoming faces is that most of the jobs, or one-third of the jobs in Wyoming, pay wages below the poverty level. So what happens is that the people, for whatever reasons, who live in poverty are pushed into an employment market that doesn't even provide enough jobs that pay above a poverty level wages. they're not depending on welfare anymore, but their income is still too low to raise them out of poverty. So even though they're not on welfare officially anymore, they're still poor. And I think this is one of the biggest problems that people in Wyoming have, actually.
Doesn't Wyoming say that they have one of the lowest welfare rates in the country? If that's the case, how come poverty is still just as rampant as anywhere else?
The major assumption in Wyoming was that the unemployment rate is so low, whoever wants to work can work in Wyoming, which is true to a certain extent. However, if you look at single-headed families, especially female-headed families, the income difference between men and women is the highest in the country in Wyoming. Women make below national average wages, which contributes to their poverty in Wyoming. And it's just a problem with going to work. You know, it's not that easy. Just going to work doesn't lift you out of poverty in Wyoming. And this is actually one of the biggest problems. So even though they say, yeah, we reduced our caseloads, which is due to a variety of factors, not just that people went into work. There was a lot of families that did not reapply for the program after the program has changed because supposedly they didn't want to comply with the work requirements. There's other people that were exempt that are not on a caseload anymore because they don't have children under the age of 18 anymore. There's people that were penalized for not complying with program requirements, and actually I saw some figures, and there's almost as many people that were excluded from the program for not complying as went into work. So this certainly, then the Native Americans that were on the caseloads previously are not counted anymore in Wyoming's caseloads because they run their own programs. So those are one of the many factors about, because I didn't study it, but my best guess is that the state doesn't know either. The welfare leaver studies that they do are very poor in terms of data collection. They send out questionnaires to former welfare recipients and send them like $15 or so if they send the questionnaire back. They send out quite a few, but not a whole lot of them come back. And then, you know, I don't think that the data is very reliable. I don't think they really study what happens to people that were excluded from the caseloads because they didn't comply with program requirements or something. So I think the biggest problem is that you don't know. You don't know what happens to the people that were excluded. You don't know what happens to the people that went back into the workforce because the studies in Wyoming are just so poor and the data collection is very poor.
What does that say about the system?
Basically that they don't care. Would be my best guess. I mean, they spend huge amounts of money on a new computer system so they can link the different local field offices and link to other states. But the main purpose of this computer system is to track recipients and make sure that nobody receives services or money twice in different parts of the state or in different states. The computer system is not utilized to track, you know, welfare leavers. The main argument for that is it's a privacy issue, you know, that you cannot hand out data, you cannot, you know, hand out personal information about former recipients, which I think is kind of ironic because, you know, the privacy is disrespected in so many ways. National security, for example, it's okay to violate privacy issues, but not really to find out where people went after they leave welfare or were excluded from welfare.
You have an understanding of kind of two different ways that the welfare system has been handled, one in the U.S. and one in Germany. I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about Germany and how they operate.
Well, I think essentially the biggest difference is that in Germany and Europe in general, it is assumed that there are structural conditions that cause people to live in poverty, that their inequality is so universal that you cannot exclude it, but you can actively fight poverty. And so you acknowledge that the system is not always fair and that some people, you know, end up living in poverty and it's not necessarily their fault. And so there's a sense of public responsibility that the states take on. And so based on that, they developed a system where out of every single paycheck, you pay into a pot, and out of this pot, retirement funds are distributed or welfare is paid for or the medical system is supported. Each individual is contributing to a fund like Social Security works in this country, only that is expanded to, you know, Medicaid or medical care and retirement funds, unemployment insurance and all that kind of things. So it's a much more comprehensive system, and that fights, you know, different aspects of poverty. You know, it fights age and it fights unemployment and those kind of things.
Is it just as efficient as the system?
It is efficient in a way that even though our unemployment rate is much higher than in the U.S., the poverty rate is way lower. People have to agree to that kind of system. They have to agree to spend taxes on it. They have to agree to have almost half their paycheck taken out for those services. But in the end, every single individual benefits from it. And I think this is the most important understanding, which is lacking here sometimes. You know, people just say, I don't want to spend my taxes in programs like that. I don't want to, you know, have money drawn out of my paycheck for programs like that. But they don't realize that eventually they would benefit because, you know, a divorce or, you know, a medical emergency where you end up in the hospital not being able to work for a very long time, not being able to support your family, that can pretty much hit any individual in this society. And I think that people are not aware of this fact that eventually they might benefit from a system like this.
Do you think it's possible in the U.S.?
Well, I think you have to change a society first and the attitude towards, you know, spending taxes on Social Security or welfare in general, the kind of idea of taking on public responsibility. And you have this century-old myth of the American dream and you can make it if you just try hard enough. I don't know in how far this is wanted and reinstalled in people's minds on a systematic basis. But you have to change those kind of attitudes first in the general public before you can even start thinking about introducing universal programs. I mean, Clinton's attempt to universalize healthcare just flopped big time because, you know, people are not ready for it. There's a lot of politics involved. You hear a lot of debates about that kind of issues. And, you know, it's a very, very conservative approach. And when you listen to the testimony in Congress, welfare-related testimony, you know, you hear the same arguments over and over again. It's individual responsibility. We don't want a big government. We don't want wasting money on people who abuse the system. And those underlying assumptions, really, it's like a circular process between rhetorics and the public opinion. And it's just, you know, reinforcing itself. And you have to start somewhere. And I think the most effective way would be to educate the public first so that they can make the demands and make the demands to the policymakers, actually.
I'm Kenny Shook, and you're listening to People's Tribune Radio. Our guest today, Fulbright scholar Annette Tesley, received her master's degree from the University of Wyoming, where her research focused on welfare to work.
Another factor in the welfare in Wyoming was you looked at the Shoshone. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how it's different from the states?
Well, what really impressed me with their program is that they have a much more comprehensive approach to poverty. They say, yeah, okay, we have problems with substance abuse. We have problems with the lack of human capital. But on the other hand, we have problems with the lack of employment opportunities. We have problems with the lack of childcare or transportation. So it's such a rural state. If you want to take on a job, you need to rely on means of transportation. If you don't have a car, say you live in Centennial, you need to go to work in Laramie. If you don't have a car, you cannot take on a job in Laramie. And just things like that they address. And that really impressed me the most, that they have this sense of public responsibility also, you know, the sense of community and helping individuals out that cannot make it. And not automatically assuming that those people just don't want to it, or that if we help them, they're going to abuse our help. There's people who just, you know, are disadvantaged in the system and that they cannot do anything about it. And I think the primary focus should be on helping those people rather than just assuming that everybody who comes into a system, into a welfare system, is just there to abuse it. And I think this is one of the most important features, actually, that you don't assume that, you know, people just are there to abuse it. And I think this is in 96, this was one of the major assumptions they made on the federal level, and that's what justified cutting back so much on the welfare state.
Do you see the assumptions going away anytime soon?
Not really, no. I mean, I was really impressed with the new director of the Department of Family Services here in Wyoming. They actually turned around and said, okay, I think we measured the wrong thing. I think when we measured success in terms of caseload reduction, that was just wrong because the people are still poor. So now what we have to do is focus more on job training and make sure that the jobs they train for actually pay a wage above the poverty level. So I think, you know, if you have the right people in the right positions, there is actually some room for change. And I have to admit that I'm really impressed with the approach the new director takes. And I think it's very, very important to acknowledge that. So I don't know. I think with the reauthorization, the debates tend to say no to the question. I think they have a tendency to being even more stricter and saying, you know, it worked so well, people are working now, they're off the caseloads, they're not depending on governmental aid anymore. So there's a tendency to kind of glorify this whole welfare to work issue and say, it worked so well, why not? But I think it's the researcher's task right now to prove it didn't work all the way. Working is one thing, but, you know, being lifted out of poverty through work is quite another issue. And most of the welfare recipients actually face that problem. They're working full-time now, but they're not making enough money to be actually lifted out of poverty. So they're still poor.
And doesn't being able to work but still not having enough money to lift one out of poverty, doesn't that still affect the state?
To a certain extent, yeah. If you look at Wyoming, Medicaid and food stamps just went up. The caseloads are through the roof all of a sudden, you know. And so they have a lot more people on Medicaid now and on food stamps now that they've been disconnected from receiving welfare. So you don't have to receive welfare anymore in order to receive Medicaid. So basically what we do is the employer hires former welfare recipients and pays them minimum wage, and then the state chips in and pays the benefits. I don't know. So they're still depending on governmental aid in a way, but it's non-cash and it's not as obvious anymore. I have my doubts that this is any better, or that this is a better form of dependency, but there seem to be some interest involved in that, which I'm not knowing a whole lot about. But I don't see the point of having people work minimum wage and then the government paying the benefits. That still costs the government a whole lot of money. That still costs the taxpayer a whole lot of money. And it just totally contradicts the rhetorics of cutting down costs and cutting down expenses of the individual taxpayer.
I know in Washington State, even employees who hire a welfare recipient gets tax credit. Is it like that in Wyoming as well?
I'm not quite sure about that. I don't know a whole lot about it, actually. I know that from what I've seen is that a lot of the former welfare recipients make between $5 and $7.50 an hour. And actually in Wyoming you have to make around $8 in order to have an income above the poverty line. So most of the people that leave, and they just, you know, clump them together in that very broad group, $5 to $7.50, which is a huge difference. And then if you look at the yearly income, most of the former welfare recipients make less than $10,000 a year, which is clearly below the poverty line. So people are still, even those who are going to work full-time, are still very much in poverty. And I hope that this is going to change eventually with the new approach they're taking at the Department of Family Services.
What kind of society would you see where helping everybody out was the means of all of society?
Well, I think it's really fairly complicated. I think that you cannot picture a society without inequality. I think this is just... an ideology that I don't really believe in. I think there, in any society, there's inequality to a certain extent. You can't just cannot eliminate it. That's just the way the world works. But I think if you acknowledge that there is inequality and that there is unequal access to resources, and if you acknowledge that not every individual comes out the same out of the system it was born into, then you have a very good chance of fighting poverty, because then you can take on public responsibility and create a system in which those who cannot make it are not necessarily looked down upon, but said, you know, we got to help those people. There's reasons why they are in this situation. And I admit there's always people who make the wrong decisions in their lives, you know, who are poor because they didn't do well in school, or they didn't care about school, or who depend on substances and that kind of things. But there's people who just, you know, are disadvantaged in the system and that they cannot do anything about it. And I think the primary focus should be on helping those people rather than just assuming that everybody who comes into a system, into a welfare system, is just there to abuse it.
Do you have any last words?
No, that was pretty much it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to People's Tribune Radio. We just heard an interview with German Fulbright scholar Annette Tesley. She discussed many of the disturbing intricacies surrounding welfare to work in Wyoming and the U.S. However, welfare to work is only part of the political processes denigrating the lives of poor people. Not only in rural Wyoming, where almost all of the people on welfare in 1996 have been forced into low-wage retail and service jobs, but all over the country, welfare reform coming out of the 1996 legislation, programs such as Welfare to Work, have created a loss in security for millions of people. One nationwide organization creating solutions is the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Made up of poor people, working people, and a plethora of social organizations across the United States, members of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign document United Nations human rights violations. Throughout the summer of 2004, the campaign plans to set up a tent city in New Jersey and a March for Our Lives rally in protest of the August Republican National Convention held in New York City. To speak to us about the actions of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign is Kensington Welfare Rights Director Galen Tyler and Labor Party organizer Bob Brown.
Tell me a little bit about what's going on with the Republican National Convention this summer.
Yes. In Philadelphia in 2000, the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign had about like 10,000 people march down Broad Street in a permanent march. And 4 years later, after the Bush administration and seeing more people downsized, displaced, and made to disappear, the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign is committing themselves to putting on another Bushville as well as a march against the Republican National Convention.
Maybe you could explain what's Bushville and the March for Our Lives.
We know that poor people and working class people don't just have money to come to the Republican National Convention and stay in these high-rise hotels and downtown like a lot of the Republicans who pretty much got all the hotels and stuff booked up. So we're going to build our own place for people to come and stay for the entire week, as well as this March for Our Lives is going to be starting at the United Nations on opening day of the Republican National Convention with people from all around the country, with or without a permit.
And one of those people is the Labor Party. Bob Brown, why don't you tell me a little bit about how the Labor Party is participating in this march?
A number of members of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign are affiliates. Kensington Welfare Rights Union is an official affiliate in conjunction with the New Jersey Industrial Union Council have announced that a joint initiative called the Healthcare Human Rights Network that is already on the ground in New Jersey will be focusing on the issue of healthcare from now through up to and including and after the Republican National Convention.
So what is different about this convention than the one in 2000?
This convention being in New York allows us to really link up with a lot of the connections that we do have in New Jersey, which stems from the religious community to labor organizations to social workers to arts and culture to just, you know what I mean, a lot of people that's on the ground in New Jersey that are doing a lot of work around a number of issues that the Bush administration haven't been addressing. Right now, like I said, past 4 years, more people have been displaced, downsized, and made to disappear in this country. The poor has been left off the agenda, you know what I mean, for the Bush administration as well as the working class people. And people are making a conscious effort to come out and let the Bush administration know now is the time for a change.
How is this action different than the current anti-Bush campaign where people are just focusing on ousting Bush?
Poor people in this country haven't been getting no type of relief from the Bush administration or the Democrats, Republicans or the Democrats. It's not so much of just outing Bush. It's just trying to ensure that people are included and then in the issues, the actual people that are on the ground that are being affected by lack of jobs, the rising amount of people that are being thrown off of health care and doesn't have any quality or just any type of health care at all. And the people that are losing their homes, don't have housing and all that, just growing poverty in the country. These are the people we're expecting to come to New York.
The efforts that will be underway over the next 5 months will not be a Democratic Party-led effort. It will be independent of the Democratic Party, focused on the issues that are affecting people's everyday lives, healthcare being the central theme of the organizing work, but of course, as Galen just mentioned, includes a variety of issues that affect poor people and working people as well. Housing, education, jobs at a living wage, and a number of other issues. It's our feeling that the organizing that will take place, both with regard to Bushville and the Republican National Convention and the March for Our Lives, will occur as independent activity of both the Republicans and the Democrats while projecting to power and those in the seats of power at their convention of the need for total solutions to these problems, and in particular the issue of health care, where we see the most broad-based unity between the poor, the working poor, and those who at the moment are still stably employed have in common that they can unite around.
What kind of vision are you guys trying to create with this action and the many actions that the Labor Party and KWRU participate in?
KWRU being an affiliate of the Labor Party is because around the work and the issues that are affecting the people that we work with every day, it hasn't been solutions to these problems, but the Labor Party have some concrete solutions to, you know, the healthcare crisis in this country, concrete solutions to the education problem in this country, concrete issues around the housing. We're trying to get people to see that right now, throughout history, the Democrats or the Republican haven't had the best interests of the masses of this people in this country. And we need to break free and ensure that we build something in this country that allow all of us to get our basic necessities.
Social activity alone will not solve the problems that affect millions upon millions of Americans. The effort of the Labor Party is to politicize folks to act in their own self-interest, however in a political way, to make the kind of demands that are necessary in order to save their lives. Political solutions are different than demands. The Just Healthcare campaign, for instance, is a very precise formula for solving the healthcare crisis in this country. It starts with the concept that we need to have political, programmatic solutions that people can be rallied, organized, and educated to begin to make the political demands within the political process to correct those kind of problems.
You just heard from Kensington Welfare Rights Union Director Galen Tyler and Labor Party organizer Bob Brown talk about the actions taking place against the Republican National Convention. Most of the events will take place around New York City. For more information on the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, or to follow the march and the Tent City, check out the website www.marchforourlives.org. Again, www.marchforourlives.org. That concludes another edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society that strives to meet the needs of everyone's human rights. If you would like some of our other print and media resources or a list of our speakers, please call us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. Or try to visit us on our website at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, thanks for listening, and please join us next time for People's Tribune Radio.